This is X-Formation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Caden Rosebaum, and we actually have a special guest today, which I'm excited about, excited to get into issues. We have Aurelien Portuais, who is the Director of Antitrust and Innovation Policy at ITIF, and current lead of their Schumpeter Project on competition policy for the innovation economy. That is a lot. Probably need to talk to some of the comms folks. Oh, I know there's more. So also, Aurelien is an adjunct professor at the Global Antitrust Institute at George Mason University and at the Catholic University of Paris, which is where you're currently located, which is kind of nice. Thanks for having us live
from Paris.
Thanks for coming and chatting with us and talking about competition and tech and what's going on in this space.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to have a chance to discuss about those very timely topics.
Yeah, so I am really interested to have Aurelien on because he has been covering antitrust for the last couple months in his Dynamic Antitrust series, where he brings on a panel of guests. And I've been following it very closely to inform what I say and what I write. Yeah. But I think the most helpful way to approach this is to just begin with the moving pieces, because most of our podcast is going to be focused on the FTC today. There have been a lot of changes recently, right? Starting in October 2020, we have the AMG Capital case. And Aurelien, did you want to take that one first? Or
We can talk about not only the AMG case, but also the comments that the new chair has made about that case on the congressional hearing. I mean, she was very, Lina Khan, who was the new chair of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, was very skeptical and very critical about that case, which is basically an unanimous decision by the Supreme Court saying that the FTC doesn't have a power under Section 13 of the FTC Act to have some monetary relief and compensation. And she was very critical about these unanimous decisions. But if you read the Justice Breyer opinion, was of course a Democrat, and I think Lina Khan is also a Democratic chair. I mean, this is just a pure reading of the FTC Act, so we can expand the role and the ability of the FTC to collect some money, monetary payments. But at the end of the day, I think literal interpretation and strict interpretation by of the Congress mandate of what the FTC can do and cannot is very important. And so if the Congress wants to change those rules, and I believe there are some bills that are introduced in order to give the Congress the ability, the FTC, the ability to collect those compulsory monetary payments, that's great. But the FTC cannot do things that Congress didn't mandate it to do. So
and specifically, right, the FTC still has 13B authority. It's not right. Overruled, yeah. Which I found the most interesting. Yeah. What the court said was basically, yes, you can seek preliminary injunctions and permanent injunctions. And once you start the administrative process of looking into this and sending a cease and desist order, then you can ask us for injunction to stop it. And only when all of that is complete and the order is final, then you can seek monetary relief. And what the FTC was essentially doing was putting it all into one complaint and saying, court, we want a preliminary injunction, permanent injunction, and we want monetary relief, which was an expanded reading of the FTC statute, Section 13B. Yeah. And I love the policy argument piece of that opinion, where Breyer was saying, yes, maybe it does take away what you've been using to go after these wrongdoings, but those are policy arguments that should be taken to Congress, not the courts, right? Which is sort of that's what happened right before Congress said, okay, well, we've got the policy arguments now. This is in our court. Here's 16 bills. And you recently wrote about this in a summary, a very nice summary that we'll have linked in the show notes of each of these bills. And I was wondering if you wanted to go through the broad categories of the bills just to break it down for everybody.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we can talk about those bills. I mean, there's one bill that is basically prohibiting the conflict of interest so that platforms may not engage in and so-called alleged conflict of interest, which basically they say that, I mean, this is Elizabeth Warren proposal from the Democratic presidential campaign. So like a platform can run a platform, but cannot sell one of the products that are sold on this platform. And this is, of course, very targeted to, let's say, Amazon that cannot have Amazon Basics product. So just to make a very clear example. So if you look at this, I mean, it can't sound intuitive. So like, yeah, why we shouldn't have this kind of conflict of interest. Right. But at the end of the day, are we not shopping every day with those alleged conflict of interest? When you go to any kind of supermarket in the shelves, I'm sure you'll see some product from the supermarket brands itself. So that, I mean, the supermarket is also able to compete against the brand product. Why? Most of the time, it's just to offer cheaper price. And I think, so to prohibit conflict of interest for digital platforms without prohibiting for the whole economy, not only creates some discrimination, and if you do prohibit it for the whole economy, then that will stifle innovation, but also will lead to higher price because those products are most of the time, if not always, sold at a cheaper price. So
wouldn't this law also mean that effectively, like, Apple couldn't preload apps on their phone? I think this to me, when I was started reading the law, I'm like, completely. Wait a second, wouldn't this mean that, like, a whole bunch of the current internet ecosystem would just have to shift, right? I mean, there would have to be some sort of shift in how even that system works if we're applying it so broadly, which it probably would be, I would assume.
Totally. I mean, these are what we call the unintended consequences of those bills, because it looks like the lawmakers have thought of some cases when they were drafting those bills, like, as I just explained, Amazon with Amazon Basics, but they don't see that these rules will apply to so many products, not only to the offline economy, but also to the online economy. And at the end of the day, you're completely right. Well it's, would we have some smartphones with some apps that are pre-installed? Because at the end of the day, every app that we have that is already installed is already offered in the market, right? There's one app for mails, there's one app for maps, there's one app for, I don't know, chronometer or the temperature or the weather.
Flashlight, right? Flashlight exactly. Flashlight apps are like so privacy destructive. It is not well understood that literally there was a huge, huge issue a couple of years back about flashlight apps needing access to your contact information. And in fact, that's what they were doing, was collecting data from individuals and then just selling that data or being in an exchange agreement with other companies in order to actually sell that data. There was this huge, huge kerfuffle a couple of years ago about those specific apps. So
ironically, that sounds like a dark pattern, right?
Yeah, that is it. That probably could be. I don't know. We still have to finish up that paper. So we'll wait on that one.
So to just come back to the FTC then, there are some other bills, right, that give the FTC more authority to do what was struck down by the AMG Capital case, which if Congress is giving that authority, then there's really, one would think, no problem. There's the CLEAR Act, the FTC Autonomy Act, and those wouldn't be concerning. And even Commissioner Wilson commented that those aren't concerning, except for recent developments at the FTC since Lina Khan has ascended to chair.
Yeah, I think it's all part, not to go into those details for the audience, but the overall philosophy is just to have an aggressive antitrust enforcement. And to do that, I mean, the neo-Brandeisians and, of course, the new chair, because she's a self-proclaimed neo-Brandeisian, wants to move fast and break things, if you want. And she moves fast, clearly, from a couple of meetings that she had, the open meetings, the new format that she created. She moves fast, but she definitely break antitrust principles and antitrust tradition. And one of these traditions, with respect to the FTC, is the kind of bipartisan support. I mean, the FTC, because of its antitrust, and antitrust should be applied, should be designed in a kind of objective, bipartisan way. The FTC has oftentimes, if not always, been managed in a very bipartisan way. And for the new chair to move very fast she needs to get rid of this bipartisan support so that with three commissioners, before Rohit Chopra leaves for other positions, she wants to put many rules that will allow her to precisely get rid of the unanimous consent of the commission. For example, now by removal of what we call the compulsory process, one commissioner can ask for investigations by staff attorneys in the FTC, whereas it used to be that the whole commission, with a bipartisan support, would ask these investigations by the staff attorney. So what she wants is basically to impose her views, her very peculiar view, which are not well accepted throughout the antitrust community and throughout the antitrust scholarship, to impose her view. And to do so, she just needs to completely ignore the two FTC commissioners who are Republicans. And that is very, it's not only politics, right? We're not talking about politics, like whether Democrats or Republicans. It's very detrimental for the FTC in itself, for the bipartisan way of running the FTC, which has been its key pattern for the last decades.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of discussion around the DOJ recently that some of their antitrust suits were politically motivated in light of recent developments. And that's been the one key factor of the FTC, that it is bipartisan, that you can be sure that it's bringing a case for legitimate nonpartisan reasons.
That's why we have independent agencies. Otherwise, what's the point of having independent agencies? Right. Why do we have independent agencies? It's precisely trying to take away politics from the administrative regulatory managements, right? And what we see for the last few weeks, few months, is precisely the opposite of depolitization of antitrust. We see now Tim Hu, on competition policy in the White House. And now it's the White House designing competition rules or dictating to federal agencies what they have to do or what they don't have to do. Just to say, the President Biden's executive order said that we should change 2010 merger guidelines, and we should change also the vertical merger guidelines. Why would the White House say so? Why should the White House say so? Isn't it more accurate and relevant that those antitrust experts think about it? And I mean, just to talk about the 2010 merger guidelines, they were unanimously praised and, of course, accepted by both the DOJ antitrust division and the FTC, and they were unanimously praised from both sides of the aisle. And so it's very much like a very politicized way of enforcing antitrust that we used to know many decades ago, and we moved away from it, and I think for good reasons. And we're moving back to these old times for bad reasons.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was where I was going with this, right? And Will, this is more in your realm, having studied this a little longer than I have, but there are these frameworks of thinking about antitrust and competition law and policy. There's the Brandeis School of Thought, named after Justice Brandeis. The Chicago School of Thought. There is, as you mentioned earlier, the Neo-Brandeisian movement, which is a newer movement. And then there's also the Schumpeter Project, which is advocating for the Schumpeter idea of innovation first. So I just wanted to start off with the first, which is the Brandeisian view of this. And Brandeis's view is coming out of a very political atmosphere. Whenever the antitrust laws were first passed, it wasn't so much based on consumer welfare or economic competition. It was based on a lot of companies getting very big and threatening the power of the United States government. And that caused a lot of fear in politicians. And so they passed these laws in a political fashion, just to say these companies are getting very big because they're merging and they're becoming nationwide forces. We're afraid that this is going to get too big. We should look at being able to break those up. And so then Brandeis has a similar view of antitrust. And in his papers cited by my former professor, James May, he writes that Antitrust laws are not an attempt to create competition artificially, but it is the removing of the obstacle to competition, which he referred to as a cancer earlier. The diagnosis shows monopoly to be an artificial, not a natural product. Competition, therefore, may be preserved by preventing that course of conduct by which in the past monopolies have been established. And what he means is market forces, as if the market forces that create consolidated economic power are not natural, right? And it is instead the legislative force that is natural. And that was an interesting view at the time until the Chicago School, which I'm going to leave to Will. He has a better grip of this than I do.
Well, yeah, I mean, so effectively from the beginning, really in the 1970s, right, there was this huge and kind of shift, apocal shift within antitrust. Apocalypse shift, right? It really was. You did see in the 1970s this change and this embracing of, I don't want to say technical analysis, but of you know, kind of analysis within price theory. Price theory expanded pretty dramatically. There was a whole bunch of change in game theory as well, and a whole bunch of new methods were being applied to these questions of mergers and markets themselves. So there was this huge change and shift within what we, you know, one of my favorite areas of interest, which is industrial organization, IO, whole bunch of game theory, a whole bunch of these changes that occurred effectively within a very, very short period of time. And what the real application of the Chicago School and the Chicago School is, I'm a little hesitant to always frame it in this way. And the reason why is because even when you look at some of the Chicago School adherents and some of the original adherents of the Chicago School, they come down even on individual cases very, very differently. And we'll put something in the show notes again about this, but I have some even tensions of framing it even in this way. Right. Again, that's just my personal predilection, but point being, the Chicago School brought in what you would say would be economic analysis into this space, which is questions about price theory, questions about the relationship between, you know, markets and competition. And the big problem that even when we're talking about with Brandeis is which came first, right? Is it the market conditions created a certain kind of ability of firms to react, or did firms' competition create the market conditions, right? The question is where's the causal relationship run? Is it between competition and, say, output, or is it that only certain kinds of outputs can be allowed, and so therefore the firms that we have that currently survive are a product of what the market is able to bear? So this was, you know, this shifted a lot of the questions really centrally around how much can the market bear, how much do we understand about the market, and really about this ability of you know, mergers. A lot of this obviously has been pretty important in mergers and acquisitions, but I think the big effect of this is that it has made it tougher. I think very honestly, it's made it tougher to make the kinds of claims that would pass in the 1960s and 70s. Those sorts of cases are just much, much more difficult to bring nowadays. There's a much higher threshold. A lot of things have gone from, you know, the per se analysis, per se illegal, that they are just purely illegal things, to a reason-based, or, you know, a rule of reason sort of analysis, that such that you have to effectively make a case-by-case adjudication instead of just saying, you know, purely this is legal. And there's been a whole bunch of these changes that have been made. You know, resale price maintenance, there's a whole list of these things. But I think what we've seen is that now there has been a further shift, at least as I see it, especially with I don't know, there's a lot that's going on within the monopoly economic space. And so I'm always, again, hesitant to say that there's broad changes that are occurring. But I think generally people are worried about these efforts of concentration, that you do have these what are seemingly large frontier firms, as you would call them, that are producing more, that there seems to be higher markups, right? There seems to be these places where the companies that currently do exist within these markets are probably making more money than they should. So there's been a lot of research in the last 10 years, seemingly, to really, really, really underscore this point. Now, again, I'm going to put an asterisk because I think at some point in the future, I want to come back to this and really dive deeper into these questions writ large, but that's a whole different podcast. But I think what's come out of that ashes is this Neo-Brandeisian view that, hey, we need to look towards what actually Brandeis and some of these older thinkers actually had to say about these markets.
Right, and that's, these, Yeah. Well, that's what Aurelian had written down here in our show notes, but in preparation for this, his email to me just said, he writes, Neo-Brandeisian's victory on the ashes of the Chicago School, which I thought was a really interesting way to put this.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. All this discussion is very, very interesting because it's both the theoretical level and also the very practical level. Massive consequences for American consumers, and also there's a great discussion between lawyers and economists. Well, I come to have a theory that I think Neo-Brandeisians and this school of thought is made by lawyers and for lawyers. If you look at it, the antitrust has been made by lawyers, basically, from the Sherman Act to even Brandeis, 1914. And then they had this very, very clear view of a large firm is, of course, a monopoly, which is, of course, an abuse of language, and this very well-defined market that, of course, if you're a large firm, you monopolize the market. And then very later on, you had the Economist came to the discussion. So what we're talking about when we're talking about the Chicago School is basically a law and economics movement where economists have informed the lawyers and say, hey, wait a minute, you may be wrong on many instances. So what we have is that over decades, if not a century, from 1890 to, let's say, the 70s or 80s, we have a century of basically the economist talking to the lawyers and say, perhaps you may learn something from economics and that may inform the way you enforce antitrust laws. And Brandeis was against that. I mean, he was a lawyer and the people's lawyer, as we used to be called.
He's Louis Brandeis.
And the Neo-Brandeisians, very interestingly, reject the economic analysis. I'm not saying that just out loud. It's just like in Tim Hu's Curse of Bigness, it is written that we've got enough of economic analysis. We've got enough of economic experts. Lina Khan, just last month, said we've got enough of economic and econometric analysis. We should get rid of that. What does it mean? It means a return to the legalistic, formalistic analysis. And what does it mean? It means a shift from the consequentialist approach of economists, you know, because economists basically look at economic consequences, to a more deontological, imperative analysis that is inherent to lawyers, like, is it good or bad? As a moralistic point of view, that's the legal discussion. Like, do you want this or do you not like that? Right? It's a question of values. It's a question of principles. That's what lawyers like, and economists like a question of consequences. And I think we're moving back again to these perhaps very costly rules, very harmful to consumers, very harmful to innovation, but very principled, highly moralistic, highly legalistic views. And very interestingly, those in charge of the antitrust policy now with the Neo-Brandeisians in the US are purely lawyers who almost explicitly, because they've written it in their writings, reject economic analysis. Lina Khan, Tim Hu, and now even, of course, Jonathan Cantor at the antitrust division of DOJ. So we have this whole discussion of we've got enough of experts, we've got enough of economists, and this also participates from the rising populism that we see, right? The elites against the general masses, like, as you said, Will, the opposite between technocratic antitrust rather than popular antitrust, or something like a more understanding, more generous. And I think this is the whole discussion. We've had many decades of improvement of antitrust thanks to the Economist. And now we just want to turn our head away from the Economist, but purportedly. It's not like we don't understand or we're not interested. We know what they're saying, and the Neo-Brandeisians just don't want to listen to them. And I think that's, of course, we're happy and we will incur some cost, but we have to be aware of it.
And that's an interesting segue into what I wanted really fundamentally to bring you on for, is to talk about the Schumpeterian analysis of innovation first, right? And I wanted Will to get in on this and you both just talk through this, because I've been just, you know, starstruck. But then again, I'm a lawyer, not an economist, right? Like, any good argument that comes that makes sense legally, I'm with. But obviously, an economist is going to be more skeptical or able to argue against little minute points. But I just wanted to give you an opportunity first to describe the Schumpeter Project and your mission, and then we can get into Joseph Schumpeter.
Yeah. So, I mean, the basic idea is that innovation is key to not only economic growth in general, because this has been demonstrated from growth cycles, but it's key to competition. It's key to competition, not the way we've understood it for many years, many decades, in the sense that most of the time, antitrust or competition officials say that, oh yeah, competition policy, I mean, as an objective, innovation. And that's only part of the picture. Innovation is not only the objective of competition. Innovation is also the source of competition. And that is something that we see every day. And that is something that officials, enforcers, most of the time overlook. We need to protect and preserve innovation, not as a goal of competition. We need to protect it in order to have a competitive economy, in order to lay down the grounds and the foundations for a competitive environment. So we need to protect innovation as a source of competition more than merely as a consequence. And we live in a world that Schumpeter envisaged, or at least prophetized. We live in this world of creative destructions, where the disruptions that is taking place every day is beneficial to consumers, most of them. And if the innovation is not beneficial, I believe that consumers will not turn to that kind of innovations. But I think that not only the neo-Brandeisians will create many costs and many damage to the economy in terms of these new aggressive antitrust enforcement, but also I think that the Chicago School, or at least what we've done for many years and many decades, have not fully captured the entrepreneurial spirit that is at the heart of the creative destruction and that is at the heart of innovation, and thereby that is laying down the foundations of competitions. There has been for too long a mismatch between antitrust enforcers thinking, even economically. They think economically, but they think insufficiently dynamically. And the entrepreneurial role with these business realities and the way entrepreneurs think. They think increasingly in the long term. And antitrust enforcers are stuck in the short term, irrespective of economic analysis. So when we are in the platform economy, just to say one example of the industries, when we are in the platform economy, of course, you're bound to look at the very, very long term, in a sense that the profit, if you ever make some, will arise in many years. The same thing with the pharmaceutical industry, where you file some patents and there's a rate of failure that is excessively high as opposed to the rate of success and the possibility of profit. And so we live in a capital intensive economy, knowledge economy, and this capital intensive economy means that the perfect competition framework we've been into for too many years, like no profit, no market power, a marginal price charged at a marginal cost. These are completely disconnected from business realities. And I think it's time not to go back to some aggressive antitrust enforcement as neo-Brandeisians would advocate, but it's no longer possible to be stuck in these price-centric static analysis that we've been advocating for too many years. So we need to just realize that if innovation matters, if we want to take innovation seriously, we have to have an innovation-based antitrust. And there's no better intellectual figure than Schumpeter to embody that kind of intellectual endeavor.
Yeah, and Schumpeter, I think, obviously has had a huge and outsized impact and influence, obviously, in the econ space. And this is actually one of the things I really was hoping to kind of tease out a bit, because you know, Schumpeter's original, you know, the papers that are in the, 43 or 45, I always forget which one it is. Those papers, I mean, were taken up, again, back in the early 80s. I mean, one of the papers that I constantly go back to is Dasgupta and Stiglitz, which is 1980, which found this interesting kind of negative correlation between market concentration and innovation, right? That innovation seems to come from those spaces, or at least those markets that have higher concentration. But again, there was not really any causal effect, which is, at least I was trying to hint at a little earlier, a really serious problem with causal effect and trying to understand that. And mainly that paper dealt with industrial products and manufacturing goods. And even you suggested with some of this about drugs, which have very clear sort of outputs. And I think what's interesting to me about this conversation, the neo-Bayandicean conversation, and really the shift that I think that we've all seen within competition and antitrust over the last 5 years, because it really has been pretty dramatic in the last 5 years, is really that this is an issue that's, let me say it like this, is it's really hard. It's really easy to look at drug prices and drug outputs and try to figure out a new innovative product, right? And it's easy to do the same with manufactured goods, right? Industrial products have a very, very easy, clean output, and it's a tangible product. It's really easy to understand the qualities of that good, or at least, you know, it doesn't take a lot to understand the qualities of that good. Some of the things that at least seem to gin up the most conversation, you know, Facebook and Google and, you know, perhaps even Amazon, though it's probably not in the same space. Those things are intangible goods, right? The quality of what that good actually looks like is really, really hard to get at. And this to me has always been the real interesting question about innovation, how you integrate innovation within this question writ large, right? How do you, and I guess this is much more of an open question. One, how do you understand this bigger problem of you know, what you might call intangible assets or you know, products that have very intangible qualities that we're still trying to understand what those quality aspects are? And then two, what do you think is holding back the current antitrust regime from integrating in this idea of innovation? Because I know the dynamic antitrust and the idea of bringing in innovation into the conversation has been something that I've been at least aware of since the 1960s, right? This idea that you want to have some sort of dynamic view of the market, which is incredibly hard to understand.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the prime example that I constantly go back to is Instagram. Instagram, if it did not have Facebook, probably would not have been in the place that it is currently. I mean, it's a juggernaut. Instagram is really a clear juggernaut. But how do we go back in time and see, well, wait a second. How do we know if that was an okay, you know, I mean, I think it generally was, but how do we go back and do that sort of analysis at the time, understanding that there are a lot of different options to go forward or to potentially take whenever you're engaged in a merger or even new innovation?
Yeah, that's the counterfactuals issues, right?
Yes,
you always try to predict the future against counterfactuals that per definition will never materialize. There's also always this kind of nirvana fallacy that has been referred to many years ago. Say, we can, of course, think of an ideal world, like this perfect competition world, which doesn't exist, of course. We live in a complete different world. We live in a world full of transaction costs, full of information asymmetries. We live in a world full of cost and full of disruptions and unknowns. And so we need to move away to the textbook model. And that comes to my answer to your questions. How do we integrate innovations? And why is it so complicated? I think first thing is a work for economists and of course for lawyers to listen to economists and to discuss better, but also for economists. We need, if we really want to move away from a price-centric antitrust framework and to move for innovation and to have these ideas you just refer of intangible goods, of we need to move away from quantitative analysis and to a more qualitative analysis. If we want to really take seriously some subjective preferences of consumers, the fact that utility cannot easily be maximized, or that the disruptions of the new market is not just written in a textbook, it's just lived by the entrepreneurial capabilities of the firms that these firms are building slowly, gradually, and sometimes falling. I mean, we see it with the COVID recessions that so many firms are failing. But we need to understand that there's so many things that are intangible, so that the utility preference of consumers, first, is subjective. Most of it is subjective. It's not based on price, because a price increase may lead to greater utility to consumers if there's a greater quality and greater innovative product, of course. And sometimes zero-priced product are of the greatest quality, greatest utility. I just referred to Facebook. What's the value of messaging your family all over the world or your friends all over the world? What's the value of it when 2 decades ago you had to pay for phone conversations with a hefty bills for exactly the same purpose? So what's the value? It's very hard to measure. And I think economists have to move away from quantitative objective analysis, or at least objectivable analysis, toward more a qualitative subjective analysis, where we understand that we're talking about entrepreneurs, we're talking about these gales of creative destructions that will lead the entrepreneurs to try to disrupt and to tackle the incumbents from the heart. And if we have this real serious conversation, then we move away from this theoretical model of economics where you have some nice algebra, and out of this algebra you infer some antitrust conclusions. And this is a very problematic, not only for economists, but for lawyers and for enforcers. So first of all, there's a question of methodology. We have to move away from the idea of computing society with very strong assumptions that is, of course, not realistic, and that is not representative of reality. And so the more will be realistic, the better. And then, second of all, we need to put innovation first, in the sense that it's not only an objective, it's also the source. And so the innovative capabilities of the firms are not something that is great as the end of the competitive process. It is the essence of the competitive process. The ability for firms to innovate is not something great that it needs to be praised as the outcome of the competitive process, but it's the very ability for firms to compete. And innovation also needs to be differentiated from inventions. What is innovation at the end of the day? I mean, Schumpeter has 5 categories of innovation, product, whatever. But at the end of the day, innovation is different from inventions in the sense that innovation is the capabilities to put inventions into the market. That is what Alfred Chandler has described, in saying that inventions without market capabilities will just remain inventions in your head or on paper. But what is innovation? At the end of the day, is the capital injunction into the inventions, right? That's what we see with the venture capitalists, right? But what do venture capitalists? They fund invention for these inventions to become innovations. And so we need to have this understanding that we have inventions, like a patent is an invention. It's not an innovation, right? Mm-hmm. A patent is you invent something on paper, but it doesn't mean that you've innovated in the market, right? Yeah. And I think we need to have this entrepreneurial spirit, or at least perspective, that there's a continuum between invention, innovation, and then marketability of the product or of the service. But if you break these innovation incentives, or you deter anything from this incentive, then there will be some anti-competitive or against a competitive product, such as all this idea about killer acquisitions. Well, we should completely ban small companies to be bought out. That's great. Yeah. Let's do that. Then you completely kill the buyout strategies of small startups, because most of startup entrepreneurs are launched also, and if not only, with the probability to be bought out. And venture capitalists fund those startups because there's this real credible prospect of being bought out. So if we completely disconnect this process, we may disrupt the innovation incentives. And by that, we may stifle the innovation, which is at the heart of the competitive process.
This is so funny because, and I didn't plan this. This is really just, this just happened. But like our last episode is literally just talking about that. Killer acquisitions, venture capital, startups, the buyout.
I've been thinking a lot about this and have some work on options theory that I'm hoping to finish up in the next couple of weeks on exactly this idea.
Still forthcoming.
It's a very interesting topic, but we have to understand that this is exactly what, I mean, when we say Schumpeter, most of the time we assimilate Schumpeter with big business, but that's wrong. I mean, there's two ways of looking at Schumpeter. Schumpeter says that startups are very innovators, are real innovators, and we have to protect those startups. But these startups, of course, don't have the distributional capabilities of the large company, and the large company can precisely provide the capital, the fund, and the scale economies that the startups don't have. So it's not a question of opposing one against the other, like Quilla acquisitions or the acquirer is frauding and abusing the acquiree. Yeah. No, it's just a win-win situation. So you see these startups that sometimes do not make any profits that are sold multi-billion dollars to this large company, but these are precisely those prices that perhaps the startups could not have gotten at the on the capital market.
Sometimes that's the plan, right?
Exactly. And I think it's very important to understand that we need greater capabilities, not lower. And if capital injections from the big firms into the small firms is one way of competing, that's great. And also, the large firm, what is the large firm? Sometimes the large firm is a very small firm in an entry market, right? Sometimes it's entering as a large firm is a complete new entrant in a other adjacent market where they are very very strong incumbent. I mean, let's take the example of Amazon, for example. When Amazon enter the pharmacy market, who's the big player? Is it Amazon or the pharmacist? Of course, the incumbents are the pharmacies. They are heavily regulated, heavily protected. And the fact that Amazon entered the pharmacy market, well, you see that it's a quite new entrant in a market that is dominated by many incumbents. So we have to look at things very differently in an innovation perspective, just to make sure that we're not frauding innovation and stifling innovation by undue intervention. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing anything. It doesn't mean that it should be some sort of just getting rid of any antitrust rules, but at least it means a great deal of humility for economists. Again, move away from quantitative analysis or models and more into real discussion of with business, evolving business realities. And also for lawyers, not to have a short-term analysis, but a more long-term, encompassing, and transdisciplinary discussion so that we make sure that the unintended consequences of regulatory interventions are minimized.
Well, we are out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation. Touched on so many things that Will and I have been talking about for months now. Just great to have you on. We are so thankful for that and to hear about the Schumpeter project. Yeah, we will put a link in our show notes.
And to be honest, I would like to continue this conversation at some point in the future, because I think there's some issues that we didn't touch on that we were just getting into, and you know, this options, the idea of innovation. I still want to go back to this idea of falsifiability at some point. How do you falsify these frameworks? But Aurelien, thank you very much for coming on and chatting with us today and taking time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you.
Please obviously rate our show, and there will be show notes. As always, be well.
Thank you very much for having me. We'll